Turn to Joshua chapter 3, if you would. Joshua chapter 3. We are doing our Preaching Through the Bible series on Sunday evenings, and we are focused on moving through the Bible using the 17 time periods. And we're going to be in Joshua chapter 3 through Joshua chapter 24, through the end of the book. We've been moving through the 17 time periods. So far we have gone through the wandering in the wilderness, and tonight we're going to focus on the conquest of Canaan, and we're only going to take one lesson this time with the conquest of Canaan, just like we did with the wandering in the wilderness. It's not because the conquest of Canaan is unimportant, it's just that there are a few points only that I want to hit out of the conquest of Canaan. As we get further in, these time periods are going to take more and more parts, especially as we start getting into the divided kingdom, some Babylonian captivity, as we have a lot more literature to look through biblically, then that's where we're going to be spending a lot more time. But as we look here at the conquest of Canaan, it stretches from Joshua chapter 3 to the end of the book of Joshua. And we will see Judges sort of rolls right on in. It even takes a lot of the last chapter of Joshua and repeats it at the beginning of Judges. So it's not hard to make a distinction, but just know that, you know, these time periods, they can overlap a little bit. So just keep that in mind. But as we look here at Joshua chapter 3, we're going to look at an outline of Joshua as we move through. If you see a star next to, or an asterisk next to, a chapter number, we're going to be looking at excerpts of that chapter. So the first is going to be Joshua chapter 3. As we cross the Jordan, it says in verse 1 of chapter 3, Joshua rose early in the morning, and he and all the sons of Israel set out from Shittim and came to the Jordan, and they lodged there before they crossed. At the end of 3 days, the officer went through the midst of the camp, and they commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God with the Levitical priests carrying it, you shall set out from your place and go after it. They have to stay 2,000 cubits behind it. Okay? Do not come near it. You may know the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. So they consecrate themselves. And as they come up, verse 12, we'll start in verse 13. It shall come about when the soles of the feet of the priests who carry the ark of the Lord of all the earth, rest in the waters of the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan will be cut off, and the waters which are flowing down from above will stand in one heap. So when the people set out from their tents to cross the Jordan with the priests carrying the ark of the covenant before the people, when those who carried the ark came into the Jordan, and the feet of the priests carrying the ark were dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows its banks all the days of harvest, the waters which were flowing down from above stood and rose up in one heap, a great distance away at Adam, the city which is beside Zarethan, and those which were flowing down toward the sea of the Arabah, the salt sea, were completely cut off. So the people crossed opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan, while all Israel crossed on dry ground until all the nation had finished crossing the Jordan. So here God is repeating his miracle that he did with the Red Sea, with the Jordan. We saw this sort of proverbial cleansing of the people by having them go through the Red Sea, and they had water on every side. It's not quite the immersion that we would be thinking of when we think of our own baptism. But here we see that instead of the water being built up on both sides, it's built up further upstream. and it comes down. Clearly, this idea of pointing out the Jordan overflowing all its banks, it gives us the idea that this happens all the time and we can't stop it. This isn't something that was normally done at the time to try to dam up the Jordan. And so this isn't just mankind building a dam and taking care of things. This is God working miraculously. And also it rises up in one heap, so it's still flowing, and it's just getting higher and higher while all the people are crossing over to the Jordan. And God keeps that going until everyone crosses and the priests come out of the Jordan. And then it says the water came back to the way that it was. We're going to look, the next verse we're going to look at is chapter 5. But in chapter 4, we see there's a memorial set up. This happens more than once here in the book of Joshua. This idea of placing these memorial stones. We'll see more later on. But here, it's just a thank you for letting us come over into the land of Canaan that you always promised us. So they have this memorial here. And then in chapter 5, we find a very interesting moment here. Here in chapter 5, we learn that when they came out of Egypt, all of the men of that time that were of, especially of age, they were circumcised. But it turns out, verse 3, so Joshua made himself flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Haarloth. This is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, died in the wilderness along the way after they came out of Egypt. For all the people who came out were circumcised, but all the people who were born in the wilderness along the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. For the sons of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, that is the men of war, who came out of Egypt perished because they did not listen to the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord had sworn he would not let them see the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Their children, whom he raised up in their place, Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised because they had not circumcised them along the way. When they had finished circumcising all the nation, they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. And this is somewhat of a surprising detail, because what was the point of circumcision? Well, it was the sign of the covenant God had with the people. The covenant that God initially made with Abraham and on down the line. They had kept it going to keep the covenant with God. But it seems that while they were in the land, or excuse me, while they were in the wilderness wandering, they did not do this. It does not tell us if this was at the behest of the Lord, or if it was in rebellion or accidental rebellion to the Lord. It doesn't tell us which one it is, but they are uncircumcised. All the people, except her, I would understand, Joshua and anyone under 20 who had not been born in the wandering of the wilderness, they're the only ones who are circumcised. So an extremely large portion of the people here are uncircumcised. So they don't have, technically, a part in the covenant. But now that they're getting, they've come into the land, they have renewed their covenant with God. So God has now cleansed them, brought them into the land, and then reaffirmed his covenant with them by having them be circumcised. At the end of verse 5, we see a very interesting moment here, one of my favorites in the Old Testament. It came about, verse 13, when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" He said, "No, rather I indeed come now as captain of the host of the Lord." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and bowed down and said to him, "What has my Lord to say to his servant?" The captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, "Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy, and Joshua did so. So first, normally when you have some heavenly being come and present themselves before a human being, usually you can tell in their countenance. And people will become very afraid and fall down. And that's not what we see here. He just presents himself as a man with a sword drawn. And it leads to this short exchange between him and Joshua. But when Joshua is told who he is, then he gives him proper respect. People have noted that oftentimes when you fall down before one of these heavenly beings, they'll say, "Get up, you're not supposed to be worshiping me." We don't see that here. However, this doesn't say that this is the Lord, as many have tried to suggest. He calls himself the captain of the host of the Lord. So I would not ascribe to the idea that this is, in fact, Jesus here. We can have another lesson about all that later. But just that's something that some people say, and I'm not sure that I ascribe to that personally. But when we come to verse 15, which is really what I want us to focus on, do you remember who this was last said to? This was last said to Moses when he is at the burning bush. And it says there, we're told later on in the Old Testament into the New Testament, there was an angel amongst the burning bush that was talking to Moses as the mouthpiece of God. And he said the same thing, "Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." And so now Joshua is having this mirror moment, just like the people did with the crossing of the Jordan. And then there was a memorial set up. Well, he brings Moses, and they have this memorial called the Passover. And now they've gone through the Red Sea. We're seeing very similar moments here. They might be slightly out of order, but we're seeing a lot of these very same moments here. And so Joshua is told by the Lord what's going to happen here in chapter 6 in conquering Jericho. And notice here it says Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. If you remember back when we looked at Rahab briefly, Rahab tells us that they were in great fear. And they had heard stories of them coming. They had heard what happened with Egypt. They heard what happened to many of the Canaanite kings that they've already dealt with. And then think about this. You hear about this great people, which we talked about this morning in Bible class, was probably at least 1.8 million, almost 2 million people. They come out. The Egyptian army is slaughtered. You're only hearing stories about how they were slaughtered. Something about the ocean coming and crashing on them? I don't know. But you hear this incredible story, and then they vanish. They vanish for 40 years. I would be terrified. And then all of a sudden, when they reemerge, they're coming up the west bank of the Jordan, and they're coming ever closer to you, feeling the inevitable march. And what does Rahab say? Rahab ascribes it to, we all know it's God. The Canaanites got what Israel kept failing to realize. They know it's God. God is inexorably making his way toward them. And now they've shut the gates tight. No one is allowed to come in and out. And so he tells them how this is going to work here in chapter 6. And notice here, before, when Moses and God had this conversation where he had removed his sandals, there was some back and forth between Moses and God. And Moses saying, am I really going to be the one to do this? How about we pick somebody else? Right? Or, well, I can't speak eloquently. It's a lot of excuses. What we see here out of Joshua is we see none of that. He just says, okay. Joshua has had the chance to learn what Moses had not really learned by that point in his life, which is that if God's going to tell me to do something, I'm just going to do it. And Joshua has had ample reason to learn that lesson. And here's the other interesting point. After everything we've seen out of Israel so far, we see not one whit of Israel doubting what Joshua tells them. A strange moment for Israel. A very pleasurable moment to see them in a state of such apparent faith. And so they do this marching around the city. There are many who have said, well, the city would have sat on a hill. So, of course, marching around it with how many millions of people, of course, the ground would loosen and the city would fall. What human in their right mind? Let's assume for a moment that that's what God is doing. Let's just assume for a moment. What human in their right mind thinks of that? What human says, you know what? It's up on the hill. If we walk around it, the land will loosen up and the city walls will fall. What person is going to think of that? Clearly, this is at the behest of someone who is much more intelligent. And also, let's not completely remove God from the equation. This is God doing His will. And this is God causing this thing to happen. And God tells them that He reminds them of their promise to Rahab and all who are in her house, that they are going to be saved. But verse 18, as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them and take some of the things under the ban and make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So the people shouted, the priests blew the trumpets. When the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout. I don't think ground's going to loosen up that much where if I just give a shout, it's all going to give way. That's not even how avalanches work. So I don't think that's what is happening here. I think this is the Lord at work. And so they shout, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat. So the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. This isn't just, oh, well, this section fell and this section fell. The entire wall falls flat. If you want an idea as well of how this works, there is historical documentation of them having side-by-side chariot races on the wall of Jericho. That's how thick this wall is. They are having races with chariots. That wall doesn't just fall. That's a wall made to be impregnable. That's a wall that has been sitting on its ground for a long, long time. That's not just going to fall down with some marching and shouting. So this is God clearly at play. And they utterly destroyed, verse 21, everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all she has out of there as you have sworn to her. So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. They also brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. This makes sense, right? They are not part of the people. So they stay outside the camp until they are cleansed and made part of the people. Okay, and we know they're made part of the people because Rahab is part of Jesus' lineage. So we know they're made part of the people. What I also love about this verse is it's not just Rahab who had the presence of mind to hide the spies. It seems that all of her family shares this faith in the God of Israel that she has. Because the spies warned her, look, if anybody leaves your house, then their life is forfeit. And here it says all of her family is with her. And so they have the same faith that Rahab has, apparently, to hide them. So we see here they burned the city with fire, all that was in it, only the silver and gold, articles of bronze and iron, they put in the treasury of the house of the Lord. Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared, and she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds this city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son he shall set up his gates." So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. Keep verse 26 in mind, especially if you're going to be with us in our Bible classes on Sunday morning and Wednesday night. We're going to come back to this prophecy. This prophecy is, in fact, fulfilled. It's very interesting in its fulfillment. And notice here that God is with Joshua, but chapter 7 comes along, and we see chapter 7, verse 1. The sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the ban, for Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the ban. Therefore, the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. This might surprise some of us, because what you find is God considers who unclean? Everyone. Who actually made the mistake that we're told about? One person. And for us and our sensibilities of our day and age, we often will feel like that's not very fair. Well, it's one person. What's the problem? Just get rid of that one person. Let's punish the one person. But God is angry with the whole people. How is that fair? Well, if we go into the New Testament, there's this little parable that Jesus gives, as well as it's repeated in the epistles, that a little leaven leavens the whole lump. And this is what God is trying to teach his people from really the moment they enter Canaan. If we allow one iota of sin to go unpunished, it will take over. And this is going to be an important lesson toward the end of the book of Joshua, so I don't want you to forget it. So it might seem really unfair, but they have to take care of the sin amongst them because it's run unchecked for so long. And look at some of how it transpired. 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. How many times God threatened to end his people and start over with Moses. Moses doesn't even get to come into the land because of sin. And even I would go so far as to say Moses sinned, but it was finally he was fed up with the people. That does not absolve him of his guilt, but he's responding to his anger at the people. And he sins. So this is something that has to be taken care of. But they don't know this. Again, well, this seems unfair. They don't know. That doesn't mean that there isn't sin. We say this a lot. Ignorance is not innocence of the law. And even in the law of Christ, that's true. Just because I don't know what the Bible says does not mean that I am free from what it says. And so Joshua and the people get ready to go up to Ai. And it doesn't work. They are utterly defeated. Joshua, verse 6, tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until evening, both he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. Why did you let this happen? Well, Joshua, let's consider. God told you how to conquer Jericho. Do you think he had a plan for Ai too? You think this was something that maybe we should have talked to the Lord about and the Lord could have made it known to you? But now the Lord is making it known to him. Verse 10, the Lord said to Joshua, "Rise up. Why is it you have fallen on your face? Israel has sinned and they have also transgressed my covenant which I commanded them. And they have even taken some of the things under the ban and have both stolen and deceived. Moreover, they also put them among their own things. Therefore, the sons of Israel cannot stand before their enemies." And so they eventually find, starting in verse 16 to the end of the chapter, they find that it is Achan, They bring him up to Joshua in verse 24. Verse 25, why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day. And all Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. And they raised over him a great heap of stones that stands to this day. And the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger, and they named the place the Valley of Achor to this day, or the Valley of Trouble. So after this defeat, then they get rid of the cancer of sin among their people. And then they turn around in chapter 8 and defeat Ai. And then in chapter 9, we're going to see a group of people called the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites are going to give our Israelite people some trouble. Through deception, they come to Joshua, these Gibeonites, which we are told they are Hivites. Later on, it doesn't tell us that here. Verse 7, when we first see them, it says they're just called the inhabitants of Gibeon. In verse 7, they're called the Hivites. They come to Joshua and pretend, well, we've come from a long way away, not right around the corner. And we've come to be your servants. And once again, we sort of repeat the mistake that we made earlier, which we don't ask God what we should do. Okay? And in fact, the Holy Spirit takes pains to say that to us in verse 14. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. It came about at the end of 3 days after they made a covenant with them, they heard that they were neighbors and they were living within the land. Well, that didn't take long. Apparently, we could have figured that out fairly quickly. But now we know. And what an interesting moment that happens here between Israel and God is that God tells them they have to keep their promise. What were they supposed to do? They were supposed to destroy all of the Canaanites. I believe the term earlier in the Pentateuch was annihilate. They had to annihilate the Canaanites. That was what God's command was. But now we come to the Gibeonites, and God actually says, no, you're going to keep your promise to them. And this is where we learn a very valuable lesson about the promises of God. God takes his promises very seriously, and has up to this point. And God expects the same out of us. When we make promises, he expects us to keep them. Going against our word is something that God hates. And this is not the first time we're going to see this. We're going to see it later on in the book of Judges, very poignantly as well. We're going to see this play out multiple times where people make promises and God says, well, you have to keep up with the promise. Even if apparently we are in violation of what God wants, God holds us accountable to our promises. And so here the Gibeonites then become not just their servants, but more specifically their slaves. That happens in verse 23. Therefore you are cursed, you shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. And that is what happens to the Gibeonites. Then come chapter 10. We see that these five kings of Canaan learn of what the Gibeonites have done. Gibeon was apparently a very strong city. And all they know is there's peace been made. I don't know if I'd call it peace now. But there was peace made. And so they decide they're going to go and attack Gibeon. Well, remember what they promised. They promised that they would be alliances. They'd be allies of each other. So they have to go and protect Gibeon. And there's this moment here. Joshua, verse 7, went up from Gilgal, and all the people of war with him, all the valiant warriors. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not one of them shall stand before you." So Joshua came upon them suddenly by marching all night from Gilgal. The Lord confounded them before Israel, and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and pursued them by the way of the ascent of Beth-horon, and struck them as far as Azekah and Makkedah. They fled from before Israel while they were at the descent of Beth-horon. The Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died, and there were more who died from the hailstones than those whom the sons of Israel killed with the sword. This is standard fare for the Lord, taking the majority of the battle for himself. Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel, and he said in the sight of Israel, "O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Aijalon." So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jashar, "And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day"? There was no day like that before it or after it when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp to Gilgal. And this is, of course, an incredible miracle. It brings to mind, Jesus said, "Ask that a mountain shall be moved, shall be done." I think this is a little bit bigger than that. Let's just stop the sun and the moon and the earth in their course. And Joshua just calls this out to the Lord, and the Lord obliges. And one of my favorite details about this episode here is actually not what you find in the Bible. There are 17 Native American tribes that have historical record that at about this time, there was something that they called the Long Night. And it was a time that the sun did not rise for almost 48 hours. And of course, people consider that as fanciful story. But it coincides timeline-wise with this moment here. So, take that for what you will. And so they have their victory against these five kings. In chapter 11, so after they capture these five kings, at the end of chapter 10, they take over southern Palestine, which is all of the realm of these five kings. Then in chapter 11, he turns his eye to northern Palestine and overtakes it. And then in chapter 12, I just wanted to point out just a few verses here. It starts in verse 8, verse 7 really. These are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the sons of Israel defeated beyond the Jordan toward the west from Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon, even as far as Mount Halak, which rises toward Seir. And Joshua gave it to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to their divisions. And it lists every king so far. And I say so far because we're going to see later on that not every Canaanite, besides the Gibeonites, was removed. But enough of them are removed that God considers that all of the land is taken and given to the people. And we see at the end of verse 24, in all, 31 kings. 31 kings are conquered by the Lord and by his people. And then from chapters 13 through 21, they divide up the land. So we're going to skip over to 22. At the end of chapter 21, We spoke about this in Bible class. If you were unable to be with us in Bible class this morning, I wanted to read it again for you. So we see up through verse 42 is when finally everyone is given their land. The Levites are given their cities of refuge. Everybody is where they're supposed to be. So the Lord gave Israel all the land which he sworn to give to their fathers and possessed it and lived in it. And the Lord gave them rest on every side according to all he had sworn to their fathers, and no one of all their enemies stood before them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hand. Not one of the good promises which the Lord had made to the house of Israel failed. All came to pass. This is what the Lord has done for his people. He has given them the land just as he promised Abraham those hundreds of years before. Then we see at the beginning of chapter 22, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half of the tribe of Manasseh are going to cross the Jordan to their land. They wanted to take the west side, and Joshua made them promise that they would help conquer the east side of the Jordan. So they fulfilled their promise. They're going back. And in verse 10, we see that the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a large altar in appearance. And the reason for this altar is they want the people to remember, hey, you on the east side of the Jordan are not the only Israelites. Just remember that we're here too. And we want to be as much a part of this nation as you. A reasonable thing to request of your brothers and sisters. The sons of Israel heard it, verse 11, and said, behold, the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan in the region of the Jordan on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. When the sons of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel gathered themselves at Shiloh to go up against them in war. They think that this is an altar that is not for worshiping the Lord. And what we have conditioned Israel so far, this is not a fault of the Lord, this is just what he needs his children to understand, is when there is sin, you cut it out. That's what God has taught them. We saw it all the way back with Achan, and then with every group of people they've come to that were against God, what did they do, besides the Gibeonites? Slay them. Cut them down. Because we are removing them and their sin from the land. Well, what do you do when it's your own brothers and sisters? We've been fighting for what scholars estimate is about 40 years. We have been fighting. And now, what else do you do except cleanse the land of filth? The problem here is, while I can respect their zeal, the zeal that they have shown for the Lord already, no one thought to ask anyone. Because later on, it's actually that they're given the chance to explain themselves in verse 21. It says, the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and spoke to the heads of the families of Israel. Verse 23, if we have built us an altar to turn away from following the Lord, or if to offer a burnt offering or a grain offering on it, or if to offer sacrifice of peace offerings of the Lord, may the Lord himself require of it. We have done this out of concern for a reason, saying, in time to come, your sons may say to our sons, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? That's what they're concerned about. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest and the leaders, returned from the sons of Reuben, from the sons of Gad, from the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan, to the sons of Israel, brought back word to them. The word pleased the sons of Israel, and the sons of Israel blessed God. They did not speak of going up against them in war to destroy the land in which the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad were living. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad called the altar witness, for they said, it is a witness between us that the Lord is God. And then in chapter 23, we see that Joshua gives a farewell address that culminates into chapter 24, and he delivers this final history lesson. This is a very common thing to do for Israelites, for Jews. We see this many times, not just in the Old Testament, but also in the New Testament, a repetition of history. Even in the New Testament, we see Peter does it on the day of Pentecost. We see Stephen does it as well in his message. This is a very common thing to do. Let's talk about our history, remind ourselves where God has brought us to at this point, and then make their spiritual point. In verse 14, it culminates, Joshua's farewell address culminates in this point. Therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. Put away the gods which your father served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your father served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. I love that line. Make sure it's not that one, because we kind of just decimated all of them. They can't protect you. They couldn't protect Egypt either. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And their answer is interesting. Far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. Verse 19, Joshua takes an interesting approach, one that actually works with Israel. Joshua said to the people, "You will not be able to serve the Lord." What do you mean you're going to serve the Lord? You going to do better than your fathers? Our fathers didn't do a hot job. He is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgression or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done good to you, which we see all throughout the Old Testament. But this does not deter them. It reminds me of Jesus talking to the woman, and he says, "Don't give what is holy and throw it to the dogs." And she says, "Even the dogs eat the crumbs from the master's table." We see this moment here. The people said to Joshua, "No, but we will serve the Lord." And so Joshua makes a covenant. He says, "You are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen for yourselves the Lord to serve him." And they said, "We are witnesses." Verse 25, so Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made for them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. And then he raises up a stone, and then he dies and is buried in verse 29 and on. After this conquest of Canaan, this is what we call the ancient Near East looks like. This is the land that the tribes were given. A very interesting map for us. But notice here, everyone is represented by name except for Levi. But their cities are all there. And this is the culmination of God's promise to Abraham so long ago that he would give his descendants the land that he was showing him. And so here is God delivering on his promise. Let's wrap up with a few practical lessons here. In chapter 3, with the crossing of the Jordan, we learn that God always cleanses his people. He makes sure that they understand that he is God, and he cleanses them and us. In chapter 6, with Jericho, we learn that God delivers in unexpected ways. Ways that usually defy what we think is right or wise or common. In chapter 7 with Ai, we were taught only the righteous are truly victorious in God. In chapter 9 with the Gibeonites, we learned God expects us to keep our promises just as he does. That's the important thing there. Just as he makes promises and keeps them, he expects us to do the same. In chapter 10, with the sun and the moon standing still, we learn God does in fact listen to us. God hears us when we pray to him. Chapter 22, with the almost civil war, we learned we have to have appropriate zeal. Not just zeal, appropriate zeal. And this appropriate zeal usually starts much as it needed to start with them, communication. Communicate first. And then in chapter 24, with these promises that Joshua and the people make between each other and to the Lord, be careful to live out your faith. So you'll have a chance right now to live out your faith. If there are any here that are not Christians, now is also the time for you to begin your life of faith to the Lord. But for those of us who have already taken that step, sometimes we are like Joshua and the people just before Ai or with Gibeon. Sometimes we forget to inquire of the Lord. Sometimes we forget to let the Lord have a say in what's going on in our lives. And we sometimes put him on the back burner. And let's put him at the forefront and let's bring him back to the place of prominence in our lives while we stand and while we sing.